the industry was a big part of Barnsley. When it got shut down, there were a lot of devastation and people lost quite a lot of jobs.
3 decades after the miners' strike ended, coal is no longer a way of life here.
My nan always left the bunker up and to show me where she kept the coal and been to the mining museum, and it shows you the hard labour that they went through.
For these children in Barnsley, it's all in the past.
I've heard that it was quite a scary job, quite dangerous, because there's lots of things that could go wrong.
Last year, the broadcaster Michael Parkinson visited Barnsley to see the places he'd grown up.
I made the mistake of going back to Grimthorpe where my father worked and Cuddeth, and it's awful, it's desperate. They took away the reason why those places were there for the first time. But more than that, I always thought that mining communities were very, very special places. And they were a very close community because they had to be to fight off the rest. Because it was tough, you know. I remember my dad with lockouts and strikes. And I went back to remember all of that. It made me deeply unhappy. In the sense that I just thought it's not fair. It ain't fair. You've taken something away and not replaced it with anything that works. From the evidence of what I saw. You've got to be careful not to sort of start preaching to them about it, because they're stuck in a situation not of their own making, which is not right.
So how have pit communities fared in the last 3 decades?
The former coal fields are still well adrift of where they should be.
Professor Steve Fothergill is an economist at Sheffield Hallam University.
Quite high levels of worklessness, above average levels of deprivation, incomes are relatively low. Now, that's not because the regeneration efforts have failed, but the damage that was done was so great that you were never actually going to solve this problem, even within a generation. And we can still see the shadow of these job losses, even now in 2015.
Who knows better the changes in mining communities over the last 30 years than the people who grew up right here? I wondered what their experiences might reveal to us about these places today.
I don't think anyone was left unscathed. From one extreme, my dad had his first breakdown, but then I also witnessed my own mother go through anxiety and panic attacks, and I've definitely noticed people deteriorate over time.
Eve Robertson was 6 during the strike. Her dad was the treasurer at Cortonwood Pit, the very flashpoint for the year-long dispute. It was known then as the Alamo, the last stand against pit closures. The pressure of worrying about the jobs that were under threat affected her father's mental health.
My mum definitely managed to protect us from that and cover that up as much as possible. During that year, I think, if anything, the strike glued him together, just all fell to pieces afterwards. And seeing him by himself and having to cope with losing his job, losing that solidarity, it quickly went downhill, really.
Kelly Layton grew up in Edlington in Doncaster and had free school dinners during the strike. Even at the age of 6, she knew money was tight.
My mum was waiting for us to come out from our school dinners. She had a purse pinched from the buggy. When she got home, I can remember her crying. I can remember her and my dad arguing. They took a purse that had absolutely every penny they'd got in it. You know, the mortgage money, everything. And my mum worked 4 jobs just to actually try and feed us during this time. That's moulded me to be the person I am today with money. I can't now go out and just be frivolous with money, because I never ever want to feel the fear of what I felt being a child and seeing my parents go through that.
David Martin was 14 years old and living at Danesmore in North Derbyshire when his dad was on strike from Markham Pit. The local divisions followed miners' children right through the school gates.
I was guilty of not speaking to other friends because their dad went back to work. If my dad had gone back to work and people didn't speak to me, that would have been terrible. But at the time, it felt right because we should all stick together.
Laura Harrison was 14 and living at Thorn. Her dad was on strike from Askin Colliery, and she went to a Christmas party at the miners' welfare.
I thought we were a bit too old for parties. However, we were getting a free present and I got a pound voucher for Woolworths. So I went down to Woolworths with my 2 friends, best friends, and bought Wham! Last Christmas. And I've never forgot that.
We had nothing. When children were getting BMX bikes, for Christmas, I didn't have a BMX bike. Sorry. I didn't resent my mum and dad for not buying me presents because they couldn't afford to.
So looking back on it, what kind of a Christmas was it?
A cheap one. My main present was a second-hand microscope given from miners' families in France and Russia. Couldn't read the instructions, but it was a present after all.
For Colin Earle in Grimethorpe, it was a great Christmas.
Oh, but I was into Action Men. I come down that Christmas morning and the amount of Action Men vehicles and stuff that were around the tree were absolutely unbelievable. You know, they'd all been donated. Looking back now to how financially crippled families were, for somebody to do that, absolutely fantastic.
He was 8 at the time of the strike and says it's a year of happy memories despite all the hardship.
I remember days before double glazing, waking up one morning, it had been really cold. There was actually ice on inside of the windows. To keep us warm, my dad had gone with a friend to get some wood. While they were there cutting trees down, they actually got caught by a landowner. He says, I'm not going to involve the police. They actually ended up getting a job out of it, which were brilliant for me, because with my dad doing shifts, I never saw him. And if we were coming in from school, we'd have to be quiet because we were in bed. Now, he won't. At the pit, you know, it was time that I could spend with my dad playing with tractors and chainsaws. My mum and dad, it were different for them because they got worries. For us, it were like, my dad's at home, brilliant. He's not at work, yay. I loved spending the time with my dad during the miners' strike.
Simon Sayner was 15 when the strike began. His mum and brother worked for the National Coal Board at Coal House in Doncaster.
Fully supported the strike, still do. But I remember my mum going to work one day. Couldn't get into work because the miners had picketed Coal House. And my mum came home covered in soil and spit. They'd just been throwing at her and spat at her. And it's kind of like, these are the people I'm supporting and they're doing this to my mum. It was kind of mixed feelings. I was at school at Dainham, just down from Markham Main Pit. Walking to school, feeling like you're almost in a police state because you're surrounded by police. And you'd walk through all these blokes shouting and screaming and things flying all over the place. It was a hard time for a lot of people, but as a 15-year-old boy, it was quite an exciting time as well.
An episode at school brought home to Louise Harrison that the solidarity she felt at home wasn't universal. A teacher interrupted an RE lesson to give the miners' children a piece of his mind.
I remember him walking in and he started off the lesson by saying, I'm disgusted that the miners are on strike. These miners need to get back to work now. I remember sat there wanting to cry, wanted to get up and walk out the lesson. I never did, but I've never forgot it. Why I felt the need to come into the class and say that to children who got no control over whether the mums and dads were on strike or not.
The return to work on the 5th of March 1985 was a day of deep emotions.
One of the main memories I have is my dad having to get ready in his pit clothes. He went to bloke who always talked about his feelings, but I just remember such a sad wave of feeling of him going back. We all felt it, my mum felt it, because she'd been involved in Women Against Pit Closures, but I remember it was particularly bad for him because the atmosphere at the pit, I remember him talking about that and saying how awful it was. It wasn't the same going back.
In the Yorkshire village of Grimethorpe, behind their colliery brass band, the miners, their wives and children marched in their thousands. Grimethorpe has remained in the Yorkshire coalfield the most solidly behind the strike, and the orderly return to work was a celebration of village solidarity and pride in the face of considerable financial hardship.
30 years on, it's a painful memory for Ian Pyatt. Back then, he was 18 and had spent a year on strike from Ireland Colliery at Staveley.
It were, as much as anybody wants to paint it, it were a defeat. And we knew it weren't just a defeat for miners, it were a defeat for everybody, because we knew that were beginning and end for industry.
And what about that day of going back?
I've never felt as proud of that pride that day. Even now, you can see, you know, how much it means to everybody, how much it meant to everybody that were involved. We fought so hard and, yeah, we lost, but country lost. You look at your utility bills, you pay them next month and see what you're paying, what it used to be and what it is now. Once a pit's gone and as close as you were to people and you were close to them, you didn't see them again. It's like they've died and it's not just on one occasion. You know, you move to another pit and it happens again, you move to another pit and it happens again. And for what?
Michael Price grew up in Connersborough. He was 7 during the strike. After it ended, he remembers things at home took a turn for the worse.
My dad was completely broken by it, really. I mean, he did return to work, but only briefly. And he just couldn't stand it anymore. He just had to just walk out. And so, subsequently, he didn't even get any redundancy payment. They'd just been completely beaten into submission, really. I do remember him retreating into himself. He used to sit in the room a lot. Just sit for hours and hours and hours just reading books, really. And we didn't really disturb him. It must have been an incredibly difficult time for him.
He says a sense of decay settled on the area.
The hedges would start to be unkempt. Everybody was wearing ripped donkey jackets and stubble and the sort of thing you'd never really seen before. Of course, back in those days, we used to have the phone boxes and they'd just be a procession of drug addicts queuing up to phone the drug dealer. We used to use public transport, so I'd be regularly standing next to somebody smoking heroin out of some tinfoil at the bus stop.
His younger sister, Laura Price, says the years that followed were difficult.
Neither of my parents were in work for a big chunk of my early years. They didn't have a car. As I got older, I became more and more aware of other people's families having cars and going on holidays. Sometimes you see coverage of the 80s as this bright, pop-filled time. But I think, you know, when I look back, it does seem quite grey and dark and a bit despairing, really.
The government announced an immediate pit closure programme when the strike ended. In 1982, there were 300,000 miners across the UK. In 1992, 30,000. Professor Steve Fothergill is from Sheffield Hallam University's Centre for Economic and Social Research.
The truth is the job losses and the closures had started in 1985 in a big way. And by the time we get to the Heseltine closures, two-thirds of the jobs that had been there at the time of the miners' strike had already gone.
British Coal is to close 31 pits. 30,000 miners will lose their jobs, some by the end of the week.
In 1992, mining communities reeled once again.
The government called the move painful but carefully considered and said, we can't go on producing coal which can't be sold.
There is no choice but to take these difficult decisions, and I've done everything I can to help people most affected by them.
Wouldn't expect it this quick. There's no reward for men that's worked and tried to get this industry productive. There's just no way for us to go. We're the village on dole.
The scale and speed of the redundancies is breathtaking. They used to call it King Coal, but after today's massive blow, this once mighty industry has been reduced to just a handful of pits.
The government closed what it called uneconomic pits, arguing that they were a drain on the public purse. The cost of keeping them open has been dwarfed since by the Social Security Bill for maintaining areas blighted by the unemployment that followed. Professor Fothergill says the true level of people out of work has been hidden from view.
The great many of them were pushed right out of the labour market and ended up parked, particularly on incapacity benefits. That's how we've masked the impact of the pit closures. We've parked people on sickness benefits. And despite the best efforts of successive governments to bring down the numbers on incapacity benefits, they've proved intractably high.
Overall, when the pits shut, Barnsley and Doncaster each lost 20,000 jobs. So what kind of work did young men find when they left school?
They've had to take jobs that their fathers would probably have seen as women's work, working in hotels, catering, in shops, in the National Health Service. That's made the labour market more difficult for women because they face competition. So increasingly, when we look at the statistics in terms of who's out of work on benefits in the former mining areas, it isn't just men, and it was male jobs that disappeared in the pits, but it's women as well because they've been squeezed.
In 1986, when Louise Harrison left school in Thorne, economic prospects for her year weren't good.
The amount of school leavers at 16 who got a job was 6 out of my class year. 6, which is just absolutely shocking and shows you really, a year after the strike had ended, how bad it was for children of miners.
Steve Houghton, who'd been a stalwart of the NUM during the strike, was elected to Barnsley Council in 1988, becoming leader in 1996.
Communities, when the pits left, not only had a sense of sort of bitterness, but a sense of hopelessness, that there wasn't anything else. And to try and put back some aspiration into the place has been very difficult.
Just a memory now, the years spent below. But for me, those minds never let me go.
He was closely involved in plans for regenerating pit communities at a time when many people were struggling to find work.
Communities were just left literally abandoned. It was hugely difficult because, if we take the case of Grimethorpe, it took over £100 million to turn that round over a 15-year period. We couldn't do that everywhere. So some places were literally closed and grassed over. We even have a discussion about Grimethorpe, whether we should shut it and grass it over and let everybody move. Because the scale was too big and the people in the community said, no, we're proud of this place. While we are incredibly proud of our past and the mining industry and the fight that took place in 84, 85, we have been prisoners of it at times. It's always remembering where you came from and who you are and what made you who you are, but always being able to move on as well, because the world moves on.
Dr. Jeff Bright is an academic at the Education and Social Research Institute at Manchester Metropolitan University.
Sometimes events in the past, difficult periods, leave not only a material legacy, but they also leave a psychosocial legacy.
He spent years researching the impact of pit closures on young people and describes the process as a social haunting.
And those ghosts are about the sheer hurt that occurred during the strike, psychologically and materially, and of course then was redoubled by the pit closure programmes.
The ghosts of that past emerged in full force in Goldthorpe in 2013.
We're paying for the funeral, so we might as well do what we want.
The village hit the national headlines when a group of residents celebrated the death of Margaret Thatcher.
Miners what took their own lives because they couldn't afford to live when she shut pits down.
It's disgusting. She's a person. People should respect her.
We won't respect when there were people on picket lines starving. We didn't have no money. We couldn't eat. We won't respect.
I'm out in Goldthorpe in the sharp winter sunshine and I've just been chatting to a woman at the shops here. She's been telling me about her grandson's efforts to get a job. And she says all he can find are 0 hours contracts at warehouses in the Dearne Valley.
You have to go that far afield. Transport around here is just terrible.
What would you say to people who say, there's plenty of jobs, get on your bike, get out there and find them?
A lot of them are shift work, they start nights. When they finish at 6 in the morning, buses don't start well, probably 7.
Wait around.
For an hour in this weather, I know wait around, but by the time they get home, they're shattered from night time, from working. They go to bed, they're back at work. And it's just
a rat race.
Yeah, that's all I'd call it.
I've heard a litany of problems from residents here. In the last 2 years, 2 banks have closed and the Co-op supermarket has just shut as well.
The place needs help and it's like the land that time forgot sometimes.
Ian Lashmar runs Fresh and Fruity. Ian's dad was a miner and he left South Yorkshire as a teenager just after the strike because there wasn't work. 3 years ago, he came back to be closer to family and opened a shop in Goldthorpe.
I used to come here and shopping around this area. It was a nice area to come, but now, unfortunately, it's just coming into decline and there's not enough done about it.
Losing the bank must have been quite a blow.
Oh, definitely. Losing the NatWest first, but then the Yorkshire Bank after that is like the final nail in the coffin.
In all, it took a quarter of a century to restore the borough of Barnsley's GDP back to the level that existed 30 years ago. In the town centre, I asked people how they felt the area had recovered since the loss of the mines.
Probably recovered a little bit, but no, even after 30 years, it's still very raw. My husband was a miner, but we moved on and we were lucky, but some people have just stayed the same.
The jobs that have been created since the miners' strike have been low-paid, minimum wage efforts. I suppose the young kids who are coming up from schools and colleges now, they've nowhere to go.
I think there are jobs, but the input of all these people that they're bringing into the country is making it harder to get a job. I don't resent them. If they come to work and they get a better living here than they can at home, good luck to them.
I'm speaking to a young Polish man who moved to Barnsley about a year ago. How easy is it to get work?
It's not that hard. It's lots of warehouses here, machine operator or 4D driver. It's lots of jobs like that.
I've come to Ruskin College in Oxford to see Adam Winter. He moved down here last autumn to study. This college was originally founded to give educational opportunities to working-class men. It obviously now takes women as well, and it aims to give individuals a second chance at an education.
I feel like for the first time since probably being about 13, 14, that I'm Adam Winter again.
You'd never believe it, seeing Adam in such an idyllic setting, but in the last 12 months, he's emerged from nearly 10 years of using drugs.
Ketamine's a massive problem in Barnsley. Looking back on it, it's an awful drug. There isn't a particular high like you get with an ecstasy tablet or MDMA or cocaine. It's a depressant, and there's no getting away from the fact it's a horse tranquilizer.
So how did this happen? When Adam's dad lost his job at Grimethorpe in 1993, the family relocated to a middle-class community in Wakefield. When Adam's parents divorced some years later, he says moving back to rundown Kendray with his mum came as a culture shock. He was an angry teenager, and when two grandparents died, he went off the rails.
I felt that was the last restriction on me doing anything wrong. We got into a circle of knowing drug dealers, bigger suppliers essentially. So I went to ecstasy and ketamine.
His dad's love and support has been crucial to his recovery, and Adam is deeply ashamed of what he put his family through.
The relationship has been fractured because I've done things that you should never put a parent through.
You stole off both your parents to get drugs?
Yeah, or to pay drug dealers. My dad's bailed me out on a number of occasions when I've had debts. I think the only way that I was going to stop was to move myself out of the environment. So Ruskin College ticked every box. Me going up at Christmas this year, and you can just tell in the difference with him as a person. It was best Christmas I've had for 10 years.
Adam wants to teach history once he's qualified and help others avoid his mistakes.
I think I've got a lot to be able to give from an education standpoint and from a moral standpoint, from my own personal experiences and try stopping people going down the route that I did. But I will come back up north. It is my town. There's a poster outside Barnsley Football Club. It's my town, my team, my blood, and it is. It's so ingrained.
Adam's story is sadly not unusual. When the pits closed, drugs became a big problem. MP Dennis Skinner says before the pits shut, drugs simply weren't around.
Late 90s, early 2000, I would get complaints from constituents about needles in alleyways, you know.
Was it a case of the pits shut and the drugs moved in to fill that hole?
Yeah, by and large. I mean, it didn't come immediately, but it gradually began to affect all the pit areas.
Tony is from a mining family in the Doncaster area. After losing more than a decade of his life to addiction, he was helped back into work by Rob Kane from the Moving On Project.
I hear a lot of people say to reach that stage where you want to recover, you might need to hit rock bottom.
But for me, I remember saying, you know, this is rock bottom, this is rock bottom. And then 2 days later, I was high as a kite, back on that little roller coaster.
Tony's now got a steady job and tries not to dwell on the past in case that pain pulls him back towards drugs again. He told me some thoughts and even objects can act as a trigger. He couldn't have tinfoil in the house for years after he came off heroin. I sat in on a conversation between Tony and Rob.
When the community wasn't there no more, when it was everybody against each other, the differences of opinion between miners who were on strike and miners who never went on strike, the scabs, you know, it was a form of escapism. People had no work, and a new drug on scene that made you be able to escape and love everybody. Well, the problem with ecstasy was it was a horrible come-down. So you would smoke 10, 20 pounds of heroin. That's the way that heroin was introduced into that menu of drugs that you were prepared to take. The step up to heroin came after the death of my sister. I had used heroin, but I was keeping a job down. The weekends got to be 7 days long, and the addictions took over from normal life. And you end up in a hole that you never even thought you could even see near mind getting into.
Obviously, when people have serious problems with drugs, it affects relationships with families, friends.
You become a leper. You become a relative that nobody wants in their house. There's obviously a trust breakdown. The little bits that go missing out of homes, houses, things that now I'm too ashamed to even think about in your mind, admit to, but they happen. You lose what friends you did have, the right and proper ones. But you pick up new friends who are there to supply your needs and to supply their pocket with money.
A lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people, when they have, you know, a serious drug problem, They end up committing crimes to fund the habit.
It's a necessity. You have to have that money. You have to have that drug. You brazenly walk into somewhere, pick something up, openly put it inside your pocket and walk out. And I think the statistics are get caught once every 20 times you steal. That might be true to start with. But when you get more and more needy, you take more and more risks. It becomes every time. You're not even thinking about where you are, who's watching you. Is there family or is there friends in that shop? You just don't think about that until you've actually come out of the addiction altogether and you sit back and you think, why did I think that that were going to be all right? It's like having a doppelganger with you at all times.
What made you want to recover and how did you do it?
I wish I could bottle it and sell it. I ain't got a clue, mate.
Yeah.
It was an accumulation of things. One of my parents become ill, needed looking after. No sooner had I lost that parent, but the other parent then became needy. And obviously I was a little bit further along the road of recovery then. That relationship was the one who gave me my upbringing, who put the morals into me. So when I was starting to build bridges back, it was a lot easier to say no to drugs. Then I were on the methadone program. I never cheated on that methadone program because of that person.
I'm guessing sometimes you might be tempted to look back at that 10-year period of your life. What thoughts come into your head?
For the listeners now, it's pathetic to listen to somebody say that the be-all and end-all of life was heroin. It was drugs. I wasted 10 years of my life. Many people have them things happening in their lives and they don't turn to drugs. I did. So it was my fault. It was my choice. Bad one. But I can't now live thinking all them years, all them days, all them hours that I spent in prison, in police cells, in hospital, rattling, gouching. I cannot do anything about them. If I was to spend any more time thinking and being reflective on them times, then I'm wasting more time. And I've got no reason to waste my time now. I can waste my time with my grandchild fishing. I don't need to waste my time thinking, what if? There is a saying that if you keep one eye on your past, you're half blind. But to forget your past is to be totally blind. So I don't ever forget it.
Tell us about that process of getting your life back, getting back into work, really.
Believe it or not, the back into work has been easier than getting the family back. I can't make them have a relationship with me. It's something I have to live and bear. Regards to getting back to work, I thought I were unemployable. But I started doing voluntary work. Then a job come up. And the one thing that got me that job was I'd done 5 years. What better recommendation is that, well, he turned up for 5 years for naught. I've enjoyed getting back into work.
The Moving On project started as a pilot 6 years ago in Mexborough. It's run by Doncaster West Development Trust and helps people who've come through a drink or drugs problem to take the crucial next step into education or work. It's funded by Public Health Doncaster. Rob Kane says starting education, training and getting a job all help prevent a relapse.
Boredom is a trigger. When people are bored and they're trying to forget about using, but it's very difficult unless they've got somewhere to go, something to do. A lot of people have come out of that addiction with really low self-esteem, low confidence, not a lot of employment experience, feeling like they've wasted all that time, a lot of regret. But once we start working with people, often it might be the first time in their lives when they've actually set out to do something and completed it and got the certificate. So one thing leads to another, and then before you know it, a lot of people end up going to college, might end up going to do diplomas, and then they're ready for us to support them with searching and applying for jobs.
The social and financial costs of drug use are heavy. Rob told me about catching up in the street with one man he'd helped who'd once been on the top 10 repeat offenders list in Doncaster.
To see that person and he's working, he's full time, he's earning money, his life has transformed 180 degrees, he's just turned round, and for people like him and, you know, several others to say, I couldn't have done that without you, is really what gets me out of bed in the morning.
I'm at a noisy drop-in centre in Barnsley and I've just met Pat, who's 36 and volunteers here. Years ago, when she was a heroin addict, she used to come here for food parcels. It's a terrible tale. Her 12-year drug habit led to a criminal record and her children being taken into care. She's now clean, she's got two of the children back with her and is desperate to find work. But with a gaping hole in her past, employers